Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. We're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Monday night, just want to get into dietary for a minute. Monday night, I got to tell you, I had an epiphany in cooking in my house. I got to tell you, I'm somehow influenced sometimes by stories. In other words, if I tell a story about Italy or Italian, I wind up eating Italian food. If that day I'm excited over an Indian story, in India I'll eat Indian food. Monday night, I had gone shopping at my local market. I would give out his name. He's a nice guy, but I don't want people to look for me there. And I said, I can't find calamari steaks. So he said, I got them in the back. They're frozen in a box. He took them out of the box for me with a hammer and a knife. He broke them apart. Then he has a machine. He put each one in a like a package that takes the air out and resealed it with the air out of it. And he gave me calamari steaks. It cost me less than $2 a piece. Can you imagine how much they cost even retail? I come home that night. I was in a mood for a calamari steak with mushroom sauce. And I've never had it served with mushroom sauce, but because the other member of the dinner wanted a steak, not calamari, I said, I want to make a mushroom sauce for the first time in my life. So I defrosted the calamari on the cold water. Never use hot water when defrosting virtually anything, because if you use hot water, you're partially cooking it, which is very dangerous. Only defrost using cold water. And then you take the plastic off, okay, then you dry them, blah, blah, blah. You only cook them 3-4 minutes on each side in a very hot pan with very little oil, or else it'll get soggy. And make sure you got a little parsley chopped up. Anyway, I made a mushroom sauce that was so good. No butter, no cream, and I defy you to be able to discern whether there was cream or butter in it. I never had anything like it. I slept like a baby. I woke up feeling like I had velvet between my joints. I felt so good that I figured I needed to feel bad. So last night, I ordered bad Italian food from a local restaurant. It wasn't bad. It's old style, like Bronx, Staten Island, Brooklyn Italian food, which is actually a pleasure compared to the upscale, white tablecloth, shishi, bad Italian food kind of restaurants that you find all over, you know, the suburbs.
And
I'm talking meat sauce thick.
Now. So Chuck, you're
like
a big
really heavy,
now, TRM,
you know,
huh?
Really heavy, everything? Like your grandmother made.
You know what? I have
your grandmother,
a tie,
not mine.
Wearing
who
slacks,
watch this in restaurants? Men over like 40.
Day.
So the wife usually
are
orders
slacks,
a meal that she knows her
pants?
Husband wants, and he orders something lean.
I'll have the
no sugar.
It used to be you were husky. Now you're
no cream, no butter, no
fat.
Make it light.
Or obese.
Make it light. No cream.
The BMI.
So he gets this lean dish. She gets this, you know,
for America. So
it's phenomenal.
We got Chuck. It's like being reunited.
Get our plate.
A little unity here on the Jerry Doyle Show. And in keeping with the unity today, Unity, New Hampshire. Has anybody been following this charade known as the love affair between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton? Did you guys see when they left the D.C. airport climbing onto their MD-80?
So I overindulged. I had nightmares last night from the meat.
Yeah.
If I eat meat late.
He kissed her on the cheek.
One nightmare after another.
Congress has taken off
on
vacation for 6 weeks to do what? To go back to the district and tell everybody how good they're doing. And now we got these two goofballs in New Hampshire trying to convince everybody, don't worry. You don't need Congress. You don't need anybody. You just need us. Together, we can just accomplish everything and do no wrong.
He was
kissing
her
off.
So the way they wrote this article, pick it up the next
in the disassociated
press. I know if I left it on Broadway,
it says
they would tow it away that night in San Francisco.
Settled into the second row
so
of the MD-80 plane.
It was all full of
they
coal.
Were smiling
oh my God,
and gesturing to
dream.
One another as they boarded.
So as I
Clinton
drove into San Francisco today,
pantsuit,
I went down
Obama
that very street to see if my car
nearly
would suddenly
identical
stop
shade,
and only go
and
backwards.
They spent the
no, but it turned out it was only a nightmare from the
talking animated. Row 2. This has got to be one of the worst marketing campaigns of all time. Is anybody buying? Oh, by the way, I did go through the top 10 worst marketing gaffes, flops, and disasters of all time. One of them included an attempt, and we're going to get to those in a little bit. One of them included an attempt in the battle between AC and DC, not the band. AC Current, and DC Current. And Thomas Edison was trying to make the case for DC Current, and he said AC will kill you, so he executed an elephant with AC Current to make his point. One of the worst 10 marketing campaigns of all time. Now, this whole touchy Barack had no suit jacket on. And they're touching each other. And they're hanging on each other. They're whispering in each other's ears. He's applauding for her. She's applauding for him.
He captured the flagship of the Algerian.
Because he got 107 votes. She got 107 votes.
When the Algerians later repudiated the agreement,
Clinton,
the British and Dutch bombarded Algiers. When Security Council resolution. Oh, right. That's really going to happen. So we're wringing our hands. All the laws are written in favor of the pirates right now. The effort needs to be stepped up into a real military gear. Bomb their cities, take their families hostage, and it's the end of the piracy. Now, if you'd rather I talk about an easy mushroom sauce instead of these affairs, fine. Fine. Years ago, there was a firm measures taken against pirates. An expert maritime writer, Dr. David Cordingly, wrote a book called Life Among the Pirates, and he said there would often be a show trial in London, Jamaica, Boston,
against
or
pirates.
Charleston when they were captured. An expert maritime writer, Dr. David Cordingly, wrote a book called Life Among the Pirates, and he said there would often be a show trial in London.
Draw the conclusion that piracy was not a good career option. But today the authorities consist of petticoats rather than real warriors. And that's the story.
So you take your 8 ounces of sliced mushrooms. They could be button or baby bellas, cremini. I like the whites. You chop them up. Don't quarter them, eighth them, and then even chop them again. You take 1 tablespoon of olive oil. You take a tablespoon of that Smart Balance if you don't want to use butter, which I don't use. You can use a half a cup of dry red wine, but I would prefer drinking it instead of wasting it in a sauce. Now, the important part of this recipe is the beef broth. I use organic beef broth. There's nothing like it. You don't want to use anything else. Now, on the side,
now, the important part of this recipe
of, flour
is the beef broth. I use organic beef broth.
There's nothing like it. You don't want to use anything else.
You get a teaspoon of
now, on the side, you get 2 tablespoons
like
of flour
take
ready and 3 tablespoons of cold water. This is going to thicken your gravy.
You saute the mushrooms.
You get
your
salt and pepper. You get a teaspoon of chopped parsley. I don't like dried. I like fresh. Take the stems off. Chop up the leaves.
Simmer a bit.
You saute the mushrooms in the oil and the Smart Balance.
And you whisk it.
Now, you could add your red wine.
You stir
a few minutes. Then you add the beef broth.
Until it's blended.
Simmer a bit, about 5 minutes.
Then it's almost done. Another
minute. Then take the flour and the cold water premixed. And you whisk it, you know, till it's smooth.
And then you add
you stir that into the mushrooms while they're cooking until it's blended. Then it's almost done. Another minute. Thickened. Bing. If it's too thick, add more broth.
I love
and then you add parsley and salt and pepper, and you got about a 1.5-2 cups of a mushroom sauce that I think is unbelievable. And you could put it on steak or you could put it on calamari, as I did. I loved it.
He's the expert.
Leave it to him. Like Paulson's the expert on the economy. Oh, yeah. Leave it to him. He'll make a rule up anytime he wants. He can give his friends another $1 trillion, another $1 billion bonus. 20 million, 30 million, 50 billion. What's the difference? It's your money. Right? That's all. They make up rules as they go along. And since nobody's in charge, nobody's at the helm, and the ship of state is lurching and listing because we have a captain who's out of control, not even on the bridge. He's already abandoned ship, Bush. It's like abandoned ship, man overboard. Where's the captain? He's chopping wood in Crawford. He's getting ready to build his library. Imagine the library, Bush Library. It's going to be a top site for visitors, the Bush Library. Like the Clinton Library, the Library, L-I-E-B-U-R-Y, I said 10 years ago, but no one heard me. They just stole it 2 years later. Another library. What is a library? It's a slush fund for a former president. A library. They all have libraries. Oh, can't wait to go in and see. I can't wait to hear Bush's tapes, Bush's famous speeches. You know, we have nothing to fear, but, I mean, he's not said anything in 8 years that anyone will remember. Nothing. There's not a sentence said by George Bush that will be remembered, ever. So what do you need a library for? He never wrote anything anyone will remember. He never said anything anyone will remember. So what's a library? A slush fund for former presidents. You know what I'm saying? Oh, yeah, look, I want to give you $12 million for your library. Terrific. Martha, could you Could you please talk to this guy in the barbershop?
Savage.
And now on to the Savage Nation. 1-800-449-8255. Debbie, KNEW, San Francisco, go ahead, please.
Yes, sir. How do you do? Thank you for taking my call. Dr. Savage, I do suffer from psychological and psychiatric illness, and I denied it for many, many years, having heard stories of my grandmother in New York, who at a mummer's parade had just been released from a psychiatric hospital and was a little too happy, so was returned by black wagon to suffer another round of electroshock therapy. So growing up, when I myself found myself to suffer from similar symptomologies, refused to go get help. And I'll tell you, I do believe that humans, and I find it interesting that rather than recognizing that we do produce very...
All right, so but what is your main point? Of course there's mental illness. There's always been, you know, marginally crazy people and overtly crazy people. We know that. So what is it that we're disagreeing on?
Well, I think it's not subjective, sir. I think that there is a scientific way of producing diagnoses by way of examining common symptomologies and behavior. And
it's not that precise. That's the point, and that's where the rub lies. The doctors would have you believe that it's easy to diagnose and definitively diagnose that mental illness, and I disagree entirely. It's not that easy. Now, I've seen brain scan studies, don't get me wrong. I've seen the different colorations in schizophrenics and others, but we have no fundamental argument here. In other words, I know there are people who are unstable. I know there are people who are totally crazy, and I know people who are rock steady and never suffer any such orientation. So where the argument arises is, can we control some of these proclivities through means other than medication is the only argument that I think we're having.
Well, I definitely think it can be controlled through medication. The disappointment...
No, you didn't hear me. You see, you went right over what I said. I said, can some of these symptoms or conditions be controlled with means other than medication?
I think it depends to what extent an individual is suffering. In my case, the answer is no. I spent many, many years seeking out. I went to Marin County. I saw the best nutritional therapist, and I wish I could say their names on air.
Did you try mega doses? I'm going to pick one thing out of the air. Did you try massive doses of niacin?
Sir, I tried niacin until my skin was so red. I look like...
I'm only asking because I want to know how far you went along with nutritional therapies. Of course, they're not going to work in all cases, but you did try Dr. Hoffer's niacin therapy.
I had more niacin in my blood. I went to Oregon. I went to L.A. I had neurosurgery for a very bizarre...
cases. But you did try Dr. Hoffer's niacin therapy.
I had more niacin in my blood. I went to Oregon. I went to L.A. I had neurosurgery for a very bizarre...
And they looked at your iron levels. They looked at your folic acid levels, correct?
Everything. I had more blood panels drawn from me.
You went that route. The route didn't help you, and now you're on major anti-psychiatric drugs, and you feel better, correct?
I absolutely feel better, and I've been on...
Well, no one's arguing with that. But I'm saying don't put children on Ritalin the minute they show signs of being a boy.
I absolutely agree with that as well.
All right, so there's no argument. You'll get me crazy if I keep talking to you another three minutes. Three more minutes, I'll need to reach for a pill. 1-800-449-8255. You can go crazy from it. I once went and visited a holy man, a religious teacher. He was a former pugilist, a boxer, who then went into religion and became a religious guy. But he still maintained the man of the street. He knew reality. In other words, he didn't come from like an effete background. I was suffering at the time through various things that were going on in my life, mainly societal social engineering that made me feel like a failure because I was not granted what I had earned because they wanted to put people with less qualifications and of other races and of other sexual orientations. Total morons, by the way, given jobs, which is why the university has fundamentally collapsed in America in many departments, certainly not in all. And I was feeling it. I had two young children. I didn't know what was wrong. I killed myself. I did great work. I published my dissertation at Harvard, at a Harvard University journal. I mean, it was pretty good stuff that I did. And they hired whack job moron feminist tree huggers or people from countries of
origin other than the United States of America to make them feel good and to look good on the brochures. So I go to see this holy man, and he says to me, what is exactly your problem? And I explain it to him. And he says to me, you know, we have a saying which says that if you take a stick and you put it into a dog, he used the word, I can't say it, let's say dog waste, I'll put it that way on the show. And he says, no matter which way you turn the stick, it's still dog waste. And he said, now, if you don't mind, I have to excuse myself right now. I got very mad at him. I was fuming because I wanted some mystical experience in this holy man's office. He told me, if you take a stick and you put it in, you know what, and no matter how you move the stick around, it's still you know what. What he was telling me is stop moving the stick around and you know what. And he was right. See, so there are many ways to cure problems. They're not all medicatable. Not everything needs medication. Sometimes common sense works. That's what I'm trying to tell you, is that there's an epidemic of loss of common sense. An epidemic of loss of common sense. We have a nation of ninnies. Everyone walks around, medication. I want my medication. I want my crutch. I want my drug. I want my medication. I want Uncle Sam to pay for my medication. I'm sickly. I want my drug. Well, maybe you need your drug or maybe you don't. Maybe you're just a weak individual who refuses to take control of your own life. You know, you have diabetes and you're still eating Krispy Kreme. I wouldn't give you medication. I'd make you pay for your medication if you refuse to modify your diet. And you want me to pay for your diabetic treatment, for your treatment for diabetes, and so forth and so on. If you're not willing to help yourself, why should I help you? That's why our taxes are out of control in this country. But more than that, psychiatry is often used as mind control, societal control in our country. And I want to make a very big political point now, because we're moving very, very close to the ex-Soviet Union, where psychiatrists were used to diagnose people who were antisocial or anti-political. They were then taken away by the secret police, medicated into submission, and thrown into re-education camps. If you think we're not moving in that direction, my friend, you are mistaken. Some well-meaning psychiatrists are this far away from recommending that political dissidents in this country not be medicated. Trust me on this. I'm sure it's being discussed. That anyone who suffers this phobia or that phobia can only be treated with major pharmaceuticals.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
Danny, on K Dawn in Las Vegas, go ahead, please.
Michael, I'm dying over here to hear anything you say positive. I'm a fan, but I think you're becoming a chronic pessimist.
Wait a minute. Is it illegal to be a pessimist?
We're not talking about law. We're talking about an entertainment show with information. I'm referring people to you, too, that I've referred.
Oh, well, excuse me. What do you want me to do? Perform for you?
Mike?
Well, what do you want me to do? Get a string that you can pull from Las Vegas?
Mike, a little bit of positive. That's all.
All right, why don't you give me something positive? Go ahead. You give me something positive. Some nice optimistic music for you out there to keep all your Republicans happy. Can do. Put your mind to it. Put your shoulder to the grind. Put your shoulder to the wheel. Make up your mind. You can win. You're a winner. No negative. Be positive. Think positive. Only positive music and positive news. Everything's good. Everything's coming up roses. Bush is not a liberal. Bush is a conservative. John McCain is a good conservative. Be positive. Turn it off. You know, the thing I'll do is I'll rewrite the Bible. I'll call it the Newly Revised Optimist Bible, because if you read the Bible, it's really very negative. Take Jeremiah. You know, Jeremiah, it should be illegal to read Jeremiah in America because it's so negative. It's not positive. It's not optimistic. For example, says, for of old time I have broken the yoke and burst the bands, and you said I will not transgress, but upon every hill and under every leafy tree, you reclined playing the harlot. Now, that should not be allowed in the new Republican America. The new Republican America should revise the Bible, change Jeremiah, and it should say upon every high hill and under every leafy tree, you did recline playing the clown. And then the next passage says, yet I had planted thee a noble vine, holy a right seed. How then art thou turned into the degenerate plant? No good. That gets people in Las Vegas unhappy. So we're going to revise that into a newly revised Optimist Bible. And the phrase in Jeremiah will now say, I had planted thee a noble vine, holy a right seed. How then art thou turned into the happy clown? See, this way everybody will be much happier. We have the can-do spirit here in America. We have to think Ronald Reagan. We have to think pioneers. We have to think cowboys and Indians. We have to think conquering Hitler. We must never allow a negative thought in our mind because it's very, very bad for the economy. We must be positive. Arbeit macht frei. Every morning, go to work and say to yourself, work makes you free. That's what we need is positive. Positive. Positive, I say. We're going to outlaw negativity in America. That's right. In the new America, negativity will be outlawed. And the Old Testament, particularly Jeremiah, will be burned because it is oh so negative. No Isaiah. No Jeremiah. No Judges. No Ecclesiastes. No Numbers. No Leviticus. No Exodus. Too negative, I say. Out with thee. Out with thee. Okay, I'll be positive. People have requested that I be positive. I guess I try to be positive. I don't know how to be positive. Okay, let's start with this. This morning when I was making tea, I said to myself, your one mistake in 2007 was that you forgot to be thankful to God for all the gifts that you have been given. That's hard for me because I fundamentally am not that kind of guy who gets up and I say every morning, thank God for what I have. I should. I admit that. So I said, if you could wake up every day and say, you know what, look at what you have. See, I personally don't want anything. Let me start with me. I don't want any more success. I don't need another bestseller. I'm not boasting now. Please don't take it the wrong way. I don't want anything right now for myself. That's not what's making me unhappy. I'm not like resentful. I'm not like unhappy that I don't have this or I don't have that. I don't want anything. All I am asking, first of all, I wanted to say thank you for giving me what I give, because I told you how this happened. I don't want to go, it sounds hokey. Things had gone really, really, really wrong for me 15 years ago, no matter what I did. Everything went wrong in my life. I mean, in terms of career-wise. I was like a wildcatter. I had turned it into a family joke. I said to myself, you know what? I'm like a wildcatter who keeps drilling for wells and keeps coming up with dry holes. I said, but don't accuse me of ever having stopped throwing down those, you know, drilling. I drilled 1,000 wells and they wouldn't come up because the cards were stacked against me because I wasn't the right race. You get it? So anyway, but the long story is I made a prayer. I said to God, please, God, I've worked so hard. I can't take it anymore. I don't even want to tell you. I was 50 years old. And I had almost tapped out. I was ready to tap out and check out. I couldn't take it anymore. Because no matter which way I turned, they said white males need not apply. I got to tell you, on the MS, that's what I'm telling you. That's the way it was. Everything was like that. So then I made the tapes, and I said, God, please, just give me a living. That's all I ask you for. I don't want to win the lottery. I said, oh, please give me a living. I've tried so hard. I've done so many good things. Why are you doing this to me? And then when I stopped saying, why are you doing this to me, and said, only please give me a living, radio came along. Now, here's the interesting thing. It didn't come to me like in a lottery winning. You ask anybody who knows me going back to the first radio show. I have had to crawl on broken glass. I had to walk through fire. I had to jump hurdles in order to get where I am. Everyone knows that. And in order to keep this thing alive called the Savage Nation, it's an enormous, enormous challenge to do this correctly or as best as you can every day. 3 hours a day, like clockwork, get up every day and train for it, run for it, eat for it, sleep for it, plan for it. Because if you miss that curtain call or you get into the wrong state of mind by the time that 06 hits, you're out of business, kiddo. This business is a business that you can die with one wrong sentence, as you well know. With all of the left-wing fascists out there trying to trip you up, because we no longer live in the land of the free and the home of the brave. We live in a different country today. We live in a totally different Soviet-style America. But I'm up for the task. I'll bury them before they bury me. I will put them in an orange jumpsuit before they put me in one. I will get them out of business before they get me out of business. I can guarantee you. I can guarantee you people have left the political arena who you thought would be around forever, and I told you they wouldn't be around. People have left this campaign who I knew didn't stand a chance in you-know-where to get anywhere, and I knew they were doing it just for the publicity. They're gone. They're gone not with the wind. They're gone like dust in the wind. What I'm saying to you is there's a lot to be thankful for. But when God answers your prayers, whatever they may be, it often comes with a burden. It's not the lottery. You don't get X, you know, millions of dollars a year for nothing. You got to work it. You got to give back. So that's the whole message that I got to remember is give back. So I want to go through one more thing. I don't know where this soul searching has come from. I've written four books now, four in a row, New York Times bestsellers. That's a heck of an achievement. I got to tell you, I don't care who you are. I don't care what you try to do. You try to do even one bestseller. I did four in a row. That's like four Babe Ruth kind of things for a guy like me. So what more do I need? What more do I want? I say to myself, the family is okay. The kids are okay. They don't need me. I'm not working for anybody. Everybody's doing well enough to get through life. Whatever years I may have left, I said to myself, what do I want to do with the years that remain? So I was contemplating this for the last 9 months now. What do I really want to do? So I contemplate what people normally do when they retire. Unfortunately, I'm an inner city kid. I always have been in my heart. I don't golf. I don't play tennis. I don't knock people who do. The sports never appealed to me, that kind of thing. I found that they were too distant. They were too slow for me. I'm not saying you're slow or a retard if you play golf. I didn't say that. I understand the great skill it takes. It's just not for me. Okay, let's leave it at that. So what kind of sports do I like? What am I going to do, go boating 7 days a week? Like a yucca puck with a captain's hat? I'm going to ride around tooting my horn with a dog? What kind of life is that? I'm going to travel? I've done more traveling than any human being should ever want to do. I did it when I was young. I've been a lot of places. I've done a lot of things, but I didn't just travel for travel's sake. I travel to collect medicinal plants. The collections unto themselves are worthy of a life's work. They were put into herbaria all over the world. Unto itself, I never talk about that. Is it as good as Jonas Salk inventing the polio vaccine? No, but it's a significant little step in science that I made. What I'm saying is I could do that. I could go back to collecting plants as a hobby. But I said, I don't really want to do that anymore. I did it. I don't want that isolation and loneliness on islands anymore, sitting alone on islands with people I don't really understand and in villages every night. You ask anyone who's actually really done it, there's no romanticism involved. It's very, very difficult, and it's very soul-wrenching to sit in a strange village on a straw mat at night, night after night. It's not a lot of fun. When you're young, maybe you can imagine it's kind of a romantic thing to do, but when you are at a different point in your life, there's no romance in it. So the point I'm making, in a long story short, is that there was nothing that I really wanted to do outside of what I have been doing for these last 15 years, and that is look at the political machine as it goes by, watch America as it goes by, and try to make a difference. Now, am I imagining that I've made a difference? No, I'll tell you, we've had some real victories. For that little film critic with the insignificant show with no ratings who thinks that the conservative movement is dead, let me remind the little film critic that this show stopped the Dubai port steal. Does that mean the conservative movement is dead, Mr. Film Critic? This little show stopped the illegal immigration amnesty bill. We stopped it dead in its tracks. Not just the show, but this was the pounding drum of the anti-illegal immigration amnesty movement. Did you hear what I just said to you? We've had two or three really big victories on this radio show. And what I'm saying to you is there are other things we might be able to do, both negative and positive, to save this country, to put it back on its course, to pray to God that somebody comes along who is worthy of the title president. It's possible this little show could have some influence on that. You say, well, are you being a megalomaniac? What influence can you have? Nobody ever refers to you. You don't exist, Michael. Well, go on to michaelsavage.com and take a look at the 49 million people who have voted on my website, and I can guarantee you that the listeners to this show will determine the outcome of anybody yet. And I don't intend to.
But I can guarantee you that the listener states of America, and I'm not even sure that that person is yet on the ballot. I'm not sure that that person has yet come forward. It's possible there's a person who has not yet come forward who will appear and who will tell America exactly what they want to hear, because that's what the American people are screaming, clamoring, praying, and dreaming for. And the people will rally around them like metal filings around a magnet. That's what's going to happen, maybe. And so, therefore, there are things we can do. And that's why I'm still in radio, because I feel that I can still make a difference. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is where I find myself today. Does that answer some questions? I really didn't plan on this, you know, soul-searching exposure today, but that's it. Savage. Chico in Indiana, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Dr. Savage.
Hello. What's on your mind, my friend?
Listen, I want to tell you that you've helped a lot of ex-gang members.
Really? How did I do that?
Oh, just by the way you talk, your straight talk. And let me tell you, when I was growing up, we had uncles like you who tried to knock sense into our heads.
Isn't that beautiful? I got to tell you, man, I love this call. I love the call because we got cultural differences here. We got language differences here. We got age differences here. And look how you are saying to me that we communicate. That's the most important thing.
Dr. Savage, if you sat in my kitchen table, you'd be just like one of us. That is amazing.
Well, look, I'm not going to start now by backtracking and say I understand why you did it. But the fact is, I understand why you did it. I can understand why some kids wind up in gangs who didn't want to be there. But they had to be there, they'd be dead. That's another story. Not everybody's in the gang is an evil person, and not everybody's not in a gang is a nice person. We understand that as well. Am I correct, Chico?
Correct, sir. Let me tell you, I had to come to Indiana to get out of the state, but I work with gang members here in Indiana, Indianapolis. And I turn the radio on, and I make them listen to you.
That's amazing. Well, it's because I reflect. Remember, I'm an immigrant son, Chico. Although from a different culture, I am an immigrant son, so I still see America in a sort of distant way. It's not like I'm Father America. I'm part of something, but I'm also not really there yet. You know what I'm saying, Chico?
Yes, sir. Let me tell you.
There's other elements as well, which transcend culture, race, age, language. And those are traditional family values, Chico. I think you'd have to agree with me that when I say that 7 out of 10 black people, for example, voted against gay marriage, and 7 out of Hispanic people voted against gay marriage, even though they may have voted for Obama, it's because their family values and my family values happen to be the same.
That's right. That's correct.
And tell me, what is more fundamental to any man who's really a man other than his family? There's nothing more fundamental.
That's right.
Do you teach the kids, the young guys who are in gangs, that the real tough job is to be a father rather than to be a killer?
That's right, to be a man.
Any guy could bury his heart and shoot another man and think he's a man, but you know what it takes to be a man is not to shoot another man, but to help another man. The healer is a greater man than the killer.
That's right, Dr. Savage.
Do you teach them these kind of things?
I do, and like I say, for 3 hours at night, you teach them in some garages sometimes. In the garage, put the radio on, and there you are talking.
I love it, man. I really love it. I wish I could be there with you drinking a beer right now.
Savage.
Peter, WOR, New York City. Make it succinct. Thank you. What's on your mind?
Yes, Dr. Savage, a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks. Just
want to say that I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I can't wait to... At 6:06, when you come on, I just can't wait for that time to come. You are the... Your destiny... is for President of the United States. That's the only destiny I see in this land. You are the salvation of America, and Dr. Savage, you have to do it. I don't know how you're going to do it, but you got millions
of votes. Peter, I know this. I know that your sincerity is heartfelt. On my website, I think we have over 75 million people who have gone and said, Mike, leave radio, run for office. I can't believe the numbers. We passed the 75 million mark. I don't know how accurate this is, but I'll tell you right now,
It's in the many millions, Peter, of people who are fed up with the two-party system. They know that they're both cons. But, you know, Peter, haven't we seen in this election that without money, you can't get anywhere in this country? Haven't we seen that the system is bought and sold like so many pieces of silver? Perhaps 20 pieces of silver, if you get the meaning, Peter. Peter, how do you run against a machine where a guy like Barack Obama, an unknown man with no credit to his name, no known books to his name other than a fabricated book about his life, with no history of having achieved one bill of any significance, could attract crowds of 75,000? The answer is money, 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 brainwashing and power. You know and I know, if you're a Vietnam vet, then you know something about the history of the world, because you fought for this country, that the propaganda minister for Adolf Hitler had a name, and whose name was Joseph Goebbels, said the following, Peter. Goebbels said that if you tell a big lie often enough, it will become the truth. So if you tell the big lie that Obama is the savior over and over and over, and no matter how big a lie it was at first, the propaganda machine is daily. The gullible, weak-minded people start to believe it. Just as the myth of global warming, Peter, if you tell that big lie over and over and over again, people start to believe it. Remember, in the beginning, the Germans didn't particularly love the Jews. They didn't particularly hate the Jews. But the big lie machine started saying, Jews are this, Jews are that, Jews did this, Jews did that. And it was every day. It was like a drip of water on the mind, on the consciousness of the German people, till eventually enough Germans started to believe it was true. Peter, we're living in the greatest propaganda time in the history of this country, where the media is pushing this unknown man, where the media is pushing the myth of global warming, the media is pushing the lie that all immigrants come here to work, the media is pushing the myth that two homosexuals can get married, the media is pushing one myth after another, Peter, and they're destroying the public mind. Do you understand that?
And doctor, but you have to, you are the only salvation for us.
Peter, listen to me. I don't need to be president to be your salvation. Listen to me. God is not the president of the United States, is he? But he's your salvation. Anyone who picks up a Bible has a salvation in that. And
warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Tennessee, Sean, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I'd like to hear your story about the Making Love by the Sewer Plant. I love that one because it reminds me of something.
Why do you like Love by the Sewer Plant? There's nothing, there's not a dirty word in it, you know.
Well, I know. I guess that's a problem for certain people I know elsewhere because they always like a gory, horrible stuff, you know.
No, if you want triple X, you know, pornographic literature, you can get that on HBO any night. You can get it from anywhere you turn. But when I write Love by the Sewer Plant or The Nympho in Alley Pond Park, there's not one F word, not S word, nothing. Because what it is about life. And if life is poignant, you don't need to shock people with filthy words. That's for the subliterate inner-city psychopaths who don't have the English language at their disposal. So they have to revert to the F-word and the S-word. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. And I want to join your Nationalist Party, too.
Well, you really have a big shopping list. Well, I hope Santa visits you very soon, Sean. But right now, Santa's going to send you a copy of Psychological Nudity if you can tell me why you want to hear Love by the Sewer Plant.
Well, because I had a crush on this girl once that never happened, you know, and I had, it's basically, I, you know, imagined things. You know how young people are.
How long ago was this?
Well, it was actually over 15 or 16 years ago. I was in middle school, you know.
50 or 60 years ago or 15 or 16?
Or 16 years ago.
Oh. You know, that's an interesting question for a show. It's an interesting question for a radio show. Are there people listening to this show who still burn a flame for a love going back decades, someone you've not seen? That is, you know, I think people carry around these idealized images of someone that they were going out with or whatever, and it didn't work out, and they think, oh, I missed the boat, I should have married her, you know? And you know what makes me think of that? I watched a movie last night that I couldn't tell you, that I can tell you, I love, Ben Stiller in The Heartbreak Kid. Did you ever see that movie?
Oh, I've heard of it. I like it.
Oh, it's so good. Send the fellow a book. I got to tell you that I'm going to take a minute on this. You know, I don't get too involved in comedy movies. I happen to think Ben Stiller is a comic genius. I think he's the best. I really like the guy. I know he's a liberal. Doesn't matter to me. I judge the man by his art. His politics are not my concern right now. He's a fabulous comedian, and so is his father. Comes from a very fabulous comedian. You can see he became this way because his father was. His timing is so much better than Woody Allen, who's the step and fetch it of the Jewish genre, that they're not even in the same category. Woody, I mean, this guy is so good, Ben Stiller. Anyway, he did a movie called The Heartbreak Kid. So it opens in San Francisco, and the street scenes are great. And he's you know, a dating guy, single guy, and he's walking down the street, and a pickpocket, a mugger, grabs a pocketbook from a purse from a girl, and bangs into him, and, you know, he tries to get the purse back, then he gets sprayed in the eye, and then she says, oh, thanks for helping me, but he doesn't get the bag back, and she's a stunningly good-looking blonde girl. I forget her name, I don't even know. And blah, 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 they fall in love, and he's still afraid to get married because he's a typical single guy, doesn't want to commit. They get married, and they go on a honeymoon to Cabo San Lucas. It is a scream, what she turns out to be. She's a singer, she's a hummer. It turns out she has a deviated septum from being a coke user. She's a sex maniac. In other words, it's a stereotype of everything possible wrong with a woman of your dreams. Turns out that that's who she was. And instead of being Miss Innocent Christmas Face, she turns out to be a complete nightmare. And he's trying to tell her in Cabo San Lucas that he's fallen in love with another woman at the hotel while he's married to her on the honeymoon. And this other woman's like Miss Innocent, you know. Anyway, I can't give away all the details, but the plot is so intricate and so well done, and his timing is so good. I thoroughly enjoyed it. But it brought to mind how many people out there must carry around some idealized picture of some woman or some guy they knew 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Oh, you know, they're in a let's say you're in a bad marriage, which is par for the course. And you think, I've compromised. What if I had gone with John, let's say? What if I had married my college sweetheart instead of this lunk that I'm stuck with, stuck with all these years? You know, what you don't realize, like, you're idealizing what John was. You know, go take a look at John today if he's still living. So let's go to the callers immediately on the Savage Nation, starting with Dominic in Las Vegas. Dominic, thank you. What makes you call the show today, my friend?
Hi, Dr. Savage.
Hello.
I just wanted to tell you, when I was 17 years old, I met a Jewish girl. She was 15. And I loved her to no end, but she was Jewish, and the father didn't approve of me because I was Italian. He says oil and water don't mix.
Little did he know about oil and vinegar.
That's oil and vinegar. So he says to me,
that's what I would have said to him. You're right, but oil and vinegar do. So what happened?
He never said it to me. He said it to other people. They came back and told me. In fact, my Jewish friends, when he used to call up the candy store, we used to hang out at Lenox Road and Albany Avenue, and there was a candy store in the corner. And he used to call up, and I put my Jewish friend on the phone. He would talk Jewish to him, so he thought I was Jewish until he found out I was Italian.
So you remember this girl to this day?
I sure do, and that's 61 years ago.
Oh, come on. Well, I raised the question of, do guys or women remember first loves or, you know, college sweethearts? So have you been married and all of that through all these years?
I'm married 44 years. My wife passed away 10 years ago. I would have been married 54 years. I have three daughters, one 54, 52, and 46.
Oh, my God.
This girl.
And you still remember the first love? Is that what you still remember your first love?
You better believe it. That's my first love.
The girl that you didn't marry?
The girl I didn't marry. And the reason I didn't marry, because her husband said, if you go with him, I'm going to disown you. So I walked out of the picture. She said, I don't care what my father said.
Well, this is interesting. So what happened with her?
You know what? I don't even know. I don't know. And I walked out.
Oh, wait, what's her name? Maybe she's listening. What's her name?
Connie White.
Connie White?
Yeah, W-H-I-T-E.
All right, Connie, if you're listening to the Savage... Connie, if you're somewhere out there listening to the Savage Nation... I don't care where you are, Boca Raton, healthy, unhealthy, whatever. Call the number. I'm going to connect you up with Dominic. God only knows stranger things have happened in the world, Dominic, huh?
That was right, but I still love her.
You still love her, no less?
Sure do.
You know, here's the funny thing, Dominic. Young people don't realize that people who get older still have emotions of this type. They think that people over a certain age no longer have passion or sexual drive or yearnings. They don't understand that those things are eternal in a person's heart.
Oh, and you know what, Dr. Savage? It didn't matter where we were, and we didn't have material things then. I'd walk around the cemetery, Holy Cross Cemetery in Brooklyn, and hold her hand and give her a kiss every now and then. And in 2 years, I went with her. I never touched her because I wanted to preserve her for marriage, which I never got to even touch her.
That's how it was in those days. I remember my first, actually, Love by the Sewer Plant. I remember the girl saying to me, she said to me, no, we shouldn't go all the way. And I said to her, why? She said, because I want to save that for marriage. It's a special thing. And, you know, that was enough for a guy who had a certain sense of dignity in those days. I mean, if you respected the woman, let's put it that way, you know, not in every case.
I'm in Vegas. It's such a different world now. Before, you had to fight for it. Now it's so easy, you know.
Now they throw it at you. You don't have to fight. You have to fight against it now.
Girls give themselves so easily. It's not. You don't even want it.
At this point in Las Vegas, I mean, the economy's down. Do you actually see it in the streets? The downturn.
Oh, it's terrible. My son is in real estate. Forget it. He owns 20 homes and. Four or five people move out, and they owe they spend $25,000 to $3,000 a month. He's got to make good. He's got to pay.
Oh, boy. He's stuck with the payments.
Yeah, he's stuck with the payments. They move out.
Boom and bust. Dominic, I am sending you a free copy of my wonderful book, Psychological Nudity, because I think of all the people, you're like a person who's going to love reading this book.
Sure, though, and I love you because I understand you coming from Brooklyn and me coming from Brooklyn all the years. I lived there for a long time.
Yeah, but I'm not from Brooklyn. I'm from the Bronx. Nevertheless, it's close enough. Thanks for the call, Dominic. You got to remember, they were once young. And that old person that you're looking at, the face may be wrinkled, but the heart is as smooth as it was when they were a baby. And the heart still beats sometimes for memories that you youngsters don't understand are still inside that person. They're no different than you. The blink of an eye, you're going to be inside that wrinkled face. Respect your elders and eat your vegetables. This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Here's another story. Gannett to cut 1,000 newspaper jobs. They'll have to build new cafes just when Starbucks is going out of business. Just when Starbucks should stay in business for all of the out-of-work intellectuals who are going to be sitting in cafes with laptops sending hate mail to talk radio shows who will still be here when they're gone, the coffee shops are closing. 1,000 newspaper people will be fired. Payroll. Instead of changing their policies and starting to appeal to the readers, again, they won't change course. They won't change editorial course. They keep the same anti-American, anti-military, anti-police, anti-family, pro-gay, pro-terrorist editorial policies, and they can't put two and two together. I could save any newspaper in this country in 90 days. I could save any newspaper in this country in 90 days if only they gave the people what they want. You know, they say, there used to be a statement, if you build a better mousetrap, people will beat a path to your door. You know, it's 100% true. I can name five people I know who built a better mousetrap who are very wealthy today. They came into a marketplace flooded, and they created a new product within that marketplace, and they became successful. I'm an example of it. The marketplace was filled with talkers when I got here. People said it could never be done. They said my accent was too New York. They said I could never overcome the liberal bias. Well, how did I do it? because I gave the people what they want to hear, because I believe it down to the last molecule of DNA in my body. I'll give you another example. I complain, and too much, I complain far too much about food on this show, I admit it. In going through the stories from my autobiography and looking at what the proofreader sends back to me, and she's a young lady in another state who doesn't know me at all, I realize that I seem to spend a lot of time on food. I become my mother, in essence. For those of you who listen to the show get the joke. I don't mind if I became my mother. I loved it dearly. But there's a bigger point to it. I'm obsessed with food, with decent food. I don't mean great food. I'm not into fancy restaurants. I don't have the patience. I don't sit like a decadent slob over whether they tossed something with a certain this. I can't take it. I didn't grow up that way. I don't care whether it delights me. I care whether it's excellent quality and it's cooked right and it's fabulous. I don't need to see whether some chef with an earring and running open sores on his neck made something that he learned in a cooking school from some other moron. It doesn't do a thing for me. French Laundry they run to. To sit there like a putz and they come, oh, I ate that. How was? Oh, you should see. It took me 2 years to get the reservation. Oh, and what did they get out of it that you can't get anywhere else? But you can't cook yourself. Nothing but hot air. It's part of the decadence of the society we're living in. This stupidity and foolishness. I ate an X restaurant. I am so fed up with restaurants, I went to the Subway sandwich shop today. I stood online like every other moron. Just stood with the morons. I became a moron. Loved it. No, I didn't love waiting. It was jammed. Why is it jammed? Why is the Subway sandwich store jammed? I saw they were running an ad that sandwich is $3.99 for an extra buck. It's a foot long. So I said, you know what? I can't take restaurants anymore. That was after the Chinese poisoning the other day. The lip sticking. When she looked in my face and tongue lashed me, screaming at me, how come you're saying it's grease? There's no grease on it. That's like the guy who gets caught in bed with another woman and his wife comes home and he looks at the wife and says, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? I'm sitting in a restaurant. The dish is coated with grease. And she says, no grease in the food. Why you say grease? Cook don't make grease. She knows me 20 years, tells me there's no grease. I took my finger, put it on this piece of chicken, and ran it across a napkin. It looked like a snail walked across the napkin. I threw the money down and said, here, I'm paying. You don't pass it, I pay. That was it. 20 years, goodbye. So I go to Subway sandwich store. I'll make it quick. Finally, I get on. It's my turn. The only part I couldn't take were the people with cell phones ahead of me. I wanted to break this. I did have anger management problems in there. I got to admit it. Three men, I wanted to grab their wrists and take their cell phones and throw them in the mayonnaise. Not the man, the cell phone. And tell them, shut up and stop talking like a chick. Shut your mouth. Take the cell phone out of your hand. You sound like a stupid teenage girl. You sound like Lindsay Lohan. Can't you shut up? There are people online here. Shut up! I didn't say it. I had to control it. I did almost leave once. I did almost grab the phones twice. But I didn't. I finally managed to get to the counter. And you know what? The service was great. There's five people. Now, look at the value you get for $5. This is not an infomercial. They don't advertise on the show. I'm making a bigger point. Okay, foot-long tuna. So the first guy puts five scoops of tuna fish with mayonnaise on it. I know the mayonnaise is no good for me. Great. Now, just the vegetables alone that they put on were worth the $5. If you just want a vegetarian sandwich, it's worth it. I have half the sandwich sitting here. I can only eat a half a sandwich. Now, that means that two people can eat lunch for $5. A half a sandwich each. I'm a big eater. I can only eat a half of the sandwich. The other half is sitting here in the refrigerator. And I hope it will still be here in the year 2010 for someone who tries to steal it, as is very common in radio stations around the country. Everyone knows if you leave your food in the refrigerator, it will be stolen. At least it was in my experience in a radio station. So I guess I wanted to see what it's like to be poor again. And I decided that if Obama wins and he taxes us to death and does what I'm sure he's going to do, which is reduce the wealth of the nation to ashes, you know what? I'll survive one way or the other. I know how to eat a Subway sandwich. I could eat in a fine restaurant. I prefer the sandwich to the restaurant. I have very fine cars, some very expensive. And my favorite car is my least expensive car. It happens to be a Chevrolet camper van conversion with a television in it and captain's chairs. And this weekend, you know what? I put aside the expensive cars. Because no matter how you try to say you don't know what you're driving, you do know what you're driving, and you are making a statement. The fact is they're great cars. They're wonderful cars, but they're a little too ostentatious and over the top, even though they're wonderful, and people look at them, and you have to put up with that. In the camper van, no one looks at you because they figure, who's the schmuck in the van there? And that's good. Room for the dogs, cooler full of food built in. I drove out to the beach, actually not to the beach, but to Highway 1 North. I haven't been there in 20 years, out on Highway 1 in Northern California to play like Nick Cole.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
I have a habit. I try to keep my habits simple. Tuesday, I like to go to a certain Chinese restaurant for the chicken curry. All right, I did it again, and I walked out. I threw the money down. I wouldn't eat it. That was it. It's the last I'm going in there. There's three other restaurants that I went to for 20 years I never go into, and I'm not going to mention them. Some of them are better than this place. This was the last straw. Is it racism? I don't understand it. They look me in the eye. They know me for 25 years. I say, give me the chicken curry with no grease, no oil. All right, it comes out. When they do it right, they make it dry. And I say to her, I said, listen to me, dry, no grease. And they give me the yes, comes out coated with grease. I said, look, I can't eat it. I'm sorry, no nice talk. You know, these are, how shall I put it? There are all sorts of classes of people from every country, as you well know. These people are like from Katz's delicatessen theory, which is yell at the customer who doesn't like the food. There's no subtlety here. So I said, I'm not eating it. I'm sorry. Give it back. She comes back 10 minutes later, the same dish. They must think white people are stupid. They know. I said, you know me for 20 years. I cannot and won't eat grease. So now the owner comes over and she starts to tongue lash me. Now, needless to say, I'm not the kind of guy who takes tongue lashing easily, but I didn't react to her. I said, I'm sorry. I'm not going to eat it. She says, oh, they don't want to cook for you. I said, they don't want to cook for me? You give me a dish now that you could put in the tread of a tank? If your tank stopped running because of rust, you could take your chop suey and stick it in the tank tread. The thing would run better. It wouldn't squeak. I said in my own lingo. No, you don't have to pay. I said, all right, thank you very much. I'm not going to argue with you. I got up. No, you don't have to pay. I put down $10. I waved. I said, here, I pay. Bye-bye. Never go back. That's it. I don't understand it. If they think they're going to stay in business by doing this to people, they're crazy. You know what it is? It's a liberal city where people are afraid of ethnic minorities. And they figure they can do anything they want, run their mouth at you, and they make you feel that they're doing you a favor if you eat in their restaurant. You know what? There's a certain gesture for that from the Bronx that I can't project on the radio. But it consists of one hand over the other in a certain kind of gesture. That's what I'd like to say to you. Yeah, it's take your food and shove it. So then, but I'm still hungry. Where am I going to eat? Big deal. So I went over to an Indian buffet. Now, the danger of a buffet in the middle of the day is it'll put you to sleep if you have no self-control. I limited it to one single plate. I watched the news, and I left happily. And here I am. Now, I had to share this with you to bring you down to earth. Because as Lin Yutang wrote in The Importance of Living, life consists in watching your neighbor fall off the roof and having your hair cut every 2 weeks. Now, what does that mean? It means that we can only talk so much about international affairs. But as I've said to you, Cato the Elder in ancient Rome, when he wrote about ancient Rome, the historian, he said people may up to a certain point in ancient Rome have cared about what Roman legion was doing what, where, and which foreign province. But at a certain point, they didn't care. And what they cared about was the pebble in their shoe, which means how much does gas cost? What about the banking crisis? Are they losing their home? Why is the school so horrible? Why has California devolved and collapsed into this leftist nightmare of a state? Can it ever be saved? Why are taxes so high? I mean, those are the real issues. And then it comes back down to the election. Which one of the two clowns is going to do less harm to America? That's really all it comes down to, because neither of them are the doctor to cure this country. What you have here is an advanced case of cancer of the political system, and you got two inadequate doctors here. Which one is going to do a less of a damage to the patient? McCain or Obama? That's the only question you have to ask yourself. Don't think for a minute either of them are going to save this country. The man who can save this country or the woman has not yet appeared on the political horizon. Maybe it's your daughter. Maybe it's your son. I don't know who it is. But I know that the best and the brightest are not in the political arena. I know that for a fact. I know that the alphas never went into politics. The alphas I have known and the alphas I know are nowhere in the political arena. They're in every other arena. Doctors, lawyers, engineers, talk show hosts, you name it. They're not in politics. Politics in this country has attracted the betas and the deltas, and in this case, two gammas, if you know anything about Huxley. And I'm sure you do, that's all. I'd rather talk about ethnic restaurants and the racism towards white people. How they look at you and the food they throw at you, the gop. Because they figure white liberals will say nothing. To me, that's more important than corrupt contracting. Not all ethnic restaurants, only about 90% of them behave this way. Washington, D.C., Mike, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yeah, let's talk about the ethnic food. I called before. You knew I had a restaurant, a Thai restaurant. I called you a while back.
And oh, yes, I remember this from years and years ago.
You're absolutely correct. And, Mike, I just got back from Thailand, so I can tell you the double dip deal. Let me tell you how it works, okay? They have an attitude towards Americans like you owe them something, not just the fact that they got a job, but they look at us for a minimum of 15, 20% tip because their own people don't throw down a dollar on $100.
Wait, you're talking about when they have a restaurant over here?
Yeah, restaurant over here. And
okay, right. And Whitey has to leave a 20% tip.
Tip, and then if you walk away without a 20% tip, they're like, oh, that's Falang guy. Falang is like a slang term for a white guy or American guy. Oh, that's Falang guy. He wouldn't leave. You know, look, he only left me 10%. But wait a minute. The guy was waving his hand like the American flag looking for a glass of water. Where were you? You're scratching your butt off.
How about the white people who go into these restaurants and when they get a glass of water, they say thank you and bow down on the table with their hands together like they're having a religious ceremony?
Yeah, the phony Hindu Buddhist.
Yeah. They're all. Well, you ask for a napkin because they're very good on a single napkin. And you say, may I have another napkin? And you get it. Oh, thank you. Everything to the white person. Oh, thank you. 80 times thank you. The guy gives you the food. Oh, thank you. Like, what's he in business? Then you pay him. He should say thank you to you. And they go out, the liberals here in the Bay Area, and they say, oh, thank you. Like, it was the most miraculous, mystical experience in their life.
You know, Mike, in D.C., 50%, maybe more, maybe less. D.C. area, 60, 70%. They go out of their way to look like Ricky Martins when they come in, and they bow down. And, you know, you're just supposed to go in there, eat, get some service, pay the bill, right? But it's the same thing like you say. It's a magical mystery tour, and then God forbid they should learn.
You know what it is to a liberal? Going into an Asian restaurant for a liberal is the equivalent of a church attendance in their parents' generation. They think that they're doing something good for multiculturalism by attending the restaurant. And exposing themselves to the wide beauties of the foreign culture.
Let me tell you about Thailand also.
Have you ever seen liberals with their children in an Asian restaurant teaching them? You know, I cannot eat in a restaurant with children with coloring books, Mike. I don't know about you. There's something about ding-dong school in a restaurant. I can't take it.
They throw the bowl of rice all over. I remember going up to a guy one time.
But wait, no, let's get off that for a minute. How about children, liberals taking their children to restaurants with coloring books and Crayolas? And I mean, I'm talking upscale restaurants now.
No.
They're in there till 9:30. What are these kids on, speed? Who ever heard of a child eating at 9 or 9:30?
Mm-hmm.
I go to an Italian restaurant in Marin County, California. They're there 9 o'clock, the little people, with coloring books. And the worst part, Mike, is the parents who try to show how smart their children are by giving them a lesson at the table, like an Encyclopedia Britannica story at the table. That you should take a look. Oh, what a smart child you have. They're wonderful. Great. I'm glad you brought them out. Can't they have a cutoff time for children under the age of 10, like 9 o'clock, so I can safely go and have a meal?
And the other thing is they want it free. They want it free for the kids.
Well, they want to have children's play. But I have a friend. Wait, don't get so carried away. I have a friend who goes and asks for children's portion of spaghetti, and he's a grown-up. What do you do with that?
Throw them out.
So did you leave the... I hear the restaurant business is the worst business in the world.
Terrible. And you know what? They'll always play you, Mike. They play the hand like they don't know. They play Dopey, you know, the Seven Dwarfs, Dopey. And the next day you can tell them the same thing, and the next day and they look at you, they shake their head.
But I ate in this joint for 25 years, and every week I come in, I want it dry, no grease, no oil. Okay, they give me the... And it comes out like somebody poured
olive oil, and I'm talking bad. This is bad for the arteries. God knows what the oil comes from, what's it extracted from. I said, I'm not eating it. Why did they have to do it to me again? Did they think I would take it because she came over with a big mouth?
You see, they think everyone who is American will take their crap. And
well, I didn't take it. In fact, I wouldn't. I didn't eat it. She says, you don't have to pay. That was an insult to me. I threw the money down. I said, no, I am paying.
Well, you should have not paid, Mike.
No, I want to pay. I want to pay because I'm not a poor man. I will not have this kind of abuse. I'll never go in there again. It's over. Now, I want to ask you something. Have you noticed the quality of restaurant food, primarily Asian food, has gone drastically down in the last few months? The portions of rice have gotten smaller. The protein quantity has gone down. The vegetables are inferior. Am I the only one seeing what's going on here? It is the Savage Nation. Let me tell you the story of the shady podiatrist whose kid became an Anglophile who crashed my Jaguar. But first, we have to listen to Stan Getz and Charlie Byrd. Stan Getz and Charlie Byrd on the Savage Nation Desafinado to set the mood and the time. And I will tell you the story of the shady podiatrist whose kid became an Anglophile who crashed my Jaguar. So as the music fades away, I want to take you back in time to a childhood story. Of course, it's a teenage story at this point. I had a friend whose father was a shady podiatrist, as you can tell by the title of the story. And he had a weird podiatry practice in the back of his apartment in, I think it was Sunnyside, Queens, somewhere in that area. I have no idea what the man did in the back. He was a very strange father. Everybody was afraid of the guy. You'd go, and he was very tall. The father was very tall. He dressed kind of shabbily, but upscale, but it was all tattered. And he always had a weird look on his face. And when the father was not in the apartment, the son, who became the Anglophile later on to cover up his origins, would take you in his father's podiatry studio, clinic, or whatever it was, office. And he'd say with a snicker, I want you to see my father's rack, where he stretched people or something. And there was always something weird about this guy's podiatry practice. I don't even know what a podiatrist did. Something to do with the feet, but I think this guy did something with another part of the anatomy by implication. Now, you speed the clock up. The son who grows up in this shady apartment with a shady father, who was off-beaten, guy didn't become a real doctor, has to, throw dirt on his origins. So he becomes more Brooks Brothers than anybody we know. He adopts an English accent, and the last I heard, he had married a rich girl, oh, this is a long time ago, and became a banker with the umbrella and the whole deal. Now, there's another element to the story of the shady podiatrist whose kid became an Anglophile, which is my Jaguar XK150. Prior to the time that he became a pure Anglophile, he was still my friend, but that's before I left New York. And I had an XK150 Jag that I'll never forget. I love that car more than, well, most cars. Who remembers what car you love and this and that? But when I say I love that car, you got to remember something. We're limited by our language, English. English has one word for love. I love my car. I love my mother. I love my wife. I love my dog. I love this pizza. I love my new shoes. We're stuck with one verb. In Latin, there are 16 verbs for love, each one slightly more descriptive, depending upon the type of love we're talking about. So when I say I love the Jaguar, it's not like I love my dog or any of the other things I mentioned. Well, one night we were partying in the podiatrist son's apartment. The father, I think, was taking advance rack stretching lessons somewhere in the Grenada. And as kids would do, we got drunk and probably some other things were used at the party, who knows what. And he said, hey, can I drive your Jag? It must have been 2 o'clock in the morning. And you're a kid. Yeah, here's the keys. So he takes the car out on Queens Boulevard, 2 o'clock in the morning in Queens. And, he raced it out as fast as he could go. And his heart's pounding. He's sitting at a traffic light.
after, you know, he did his long run. The light's red. He stopped. All of a sudden, he looks in this tiny two-inch mirror that the Jags came with, and he sees a car careening right at the rear of the car. But before he could get the car in first, clutch it, gear it, and get out of there, crash, bang, boom, smashed in. The back of the car is broken off. And, of course, I've reversed the story. I think it was his Jaguar, and I was driving it, and I got hit from the rear. I really don't remember at this point whose car it was, but I do know who hit us. To this day, and I'm not making this up, you know, I know the guy's name. I remember it. He was an Iraqi. I swear to you. It was very odd because I didn't know of Iraqis at that time. But he was an Iraqi national with a pure – his name was not Saddam Hussein. I know that. Nor was it one of the junior Husseins. But it was an Iraqi national who crashed the Jaguar and broke its back. And, of course, that was that. Our friendship ended soon thereafter. Yes, it was his car. He came and saw it, and the back was broken off the car, and he started to almost cry. He didn't cry like a sissy, but he wept. And he said, you broke the back of my car. I said, I didn't mean it. I was sitting there. And that's the story of the shady podiatrist whose kid became an Anglophile. Now play Desafinado, and I'll tell you why I told you that story. Actually, the song has more meaning to me than the story, because I remember when this song came out. I don't know if I can tell that story. Is that illegal? One of the girls in the crowd had a sister who was a Playboy bunny. She was older. She must have been 22. We were 17, 18, 19. Now, I want to tell you, Playboy Bunny then was a Playboy Bunny. Today, it has no meaning. Today, they look like skanks from the lowest levels of the sewer. I mean, you watch that show with that old degenerate bum. I mean, this guy should be... Let's just stop right there. I never saw anything like these skanky broads he has in that mansion of his. What is so interesting about these lowlife bimbos he has with him? But in those days, a Playboy Bunny was really something. I mean, they were the top of the heap. At least that's how guys saw her. Who knows what they really were? They probably like every other woman on earth. You know, if they had a good figure, they became a Playboy Bunny. As long as they did the right producer meet, you know. Well, this song was very popular at that time, you see. And she was 22. And everybody in the crowd wanted to get next to the Playboy Bunny. But I was the lucky one that penetrated the ovum. And on the way home from that particular event, which, of course, I was flying high, I couldn't believe it, I was not in the Jaguar. I was in another car. I was in a Chrysler, which had the Hemi engine, but it was not the whatever. It was a Chrysler New Yorker, an old man's car, but it had the Hemi engine. So I'm driving home from that encounter with the Playboy Bunny. And remember, I'm really only a kid. And my mind was certainly not in the car. I mean, where was I? I have no idea. My mind was on cloud nine. Bang, hit from the side by a truck. The car is absolutely totaled. I got to get a tow truck. It's towed home to in front of the house. And I remember selling the car for the engine alone to some hitter kid who was going to take the engine out. We had a long talk about it and use it in a dragster.
Savage.
You know, you ever see what dogs do when you come home and you've been away for like a week? They're like the cats. Normally they're friendly, they roll over, you know, they lick you, you know, they play with. If you like ditch them even for half a day, they're like girlfriend's dogs. They're like, oh, early boy, I'm not that interested, excuse me. Come on, Teddy, come on in. Oh, not right now, excuse me, I'm not feeling very good, I have a headache. And they like march off into the other room with their head up. Dogs are amazingly sensitive that way. I knew a guy who was in the Navy on an aircraft carrier, and he said he'd have to send, like, he'd have to send socks from the Philippines back to, like, Fayetteville, North Carolina, to his wife. But unwashed socks in a baggie that she would throw at the dog so he'd remember his scent. I said, that's okay. That's a nice trick. I'll send dirty socks when the next time I go to Los Angeles. Then he says, then when I come home, the dog would immediately defecate in the hallway. Like, to show me how dare you leave me. No, that's why I like dogs, because they're overt. I don't like cats because they're covert. They're sneaky. Cats are like liberals to me. In other words, everything to do behind your back, like they take a dump behind the couch. A dog will do it right on the couch. A dog will lift his leg on the couch leg. A cat will do it in a sneaky little area somewhere, like on a book that you have in a library. You'll open it up and almost faint 3 months later. The book that I know you've all been waiting for. Psychological Nudity is the title. And here we are, 75 stories from Michael's colorful life history are contained in this limited first edition printing. And you can go to michaelsavage.com and you're going to see the picture of me holding Teddy, my dog. The classic stories I've told on the radio were translated for the written word. And I have to say translated for obvious reasons, because the spoken word and the written word are two different mediums. They're not the same. One-Armed Frank, Love by the Sewer Plant, Dead Man's Pants, Psychological Nudity. It's a must for everyone who has read a Savage book. It's an original. Kindly go to michaelsavage.com, review the cover, click.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Indianapolis, JR, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, it's a pleasure.
Thank you.
I had, when I was 16 years old, I had my first love. It was a girl that was on vacation in southern Indiana from San Antonio, Texas. We had a wonderful time. I joined the Marines and went to go see her. And I was going to ask her to marry me, and we got into an argument. And I split it up and walked out. 16 years later, we bump into each other again. And she still takes my breath away, and I just realized that she's been the basic comparison for everything, Dr. Savage.
Well, hold on. Let me ask you. You're saying you ran into her 16 years later. How long ago was that?
I just ran into her 3 days ago.
How? Just by chance?
It was actually on the internet.
So you looked for her? You looked for her?
I was on a website that I was turned into, and I started catching up with all my old military buddies. I said, what the heck, you know? And there she
was. So you basically, blah, 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 so you ran into her again, and you still, the magic is still there?
On my part, yes. I don't think on her part. It's been 16 years.
Well, wait a minute now. Did you see her physically or just on the internet?
Just on the internet. I sent her a message, and she replied on it with things that I would know. Then I replied because she asked me a question.
Is she married?
No, sir.
Well, look, women have to be more protective than men, and they are generally psychologically more protective than men. Men are much more out there like, I still like you, you know, let's get together. The woman could think you're a nut or, you know, you're a stalker, so she's being defensive and self-protective. It doesn't mean she's rejecting you. She doesn't know you, JR. She only knows the memory of you, and she doesn't even know it's really you. I wouldn't give up so fast.
Oh, I agree with you fully, Dr. Savage. That's why I'm taking this.
I would just take it very slow. I mean, I'm no, Mr. Cupid here, but I'm saying, if you really feel the same way you think about her, and you think there's a chance, and this is the girl you really want to marry or whatever, send her a couple of messages, but keep it light. Don't get too demanding and aggressive, and she'll think you're nuts. You got to say to her, you know, I've been thinking about you strangely enough, and I'm glad we ran into each other on the internet. Maybe I can tell you something more about myself. Here's what I've done. Here's who I am. Let's at least be pen pals. What's wrong with that?
None at all, sir. I have done that, and I'm just waiting on her reply. And, you know, hopefully just friends. She's the only one that I've lost track of. And
We'll let it go with that, but I'm going to tell you this. This was raised because I asked the question along these lines 2 hours ago. And I'm sure that my book, Psychological Nudity, there's only one story you want to read, which is Love by the Sewer Plant.
That's correct, sir.
Now, hold on. We'll send the copy to you, and I want you to play for me now. I Only Have Eyes for You, sung by the Flamingos, and I'll tell you a story right here on the Savage Nation. Anybody get ready with I Only Have Eyes for You, Blup, Blup? Is that the Shabup Shabup song? Because that's the one I really want to hear. Oh, you guys are good. You are good today. Shabup Shabup.
I can't see anyone but you.
This is slow. There you go. That's the whole point. All right, now that sets the tone for this story. I write, shall I tell you the story of Love by the Sewer Plant from page 57 of Psychological Lunacy? I say, remember the song I Only Have Eyes for You sung by the Flamingos? We're talking Route 42. We're talking 1956-57. We're talking a sewer plant. We're talking about Love by the Sewer Plant, First Love by the Sewer Plant. Now, this girl was so beautiful that people stopped as she went by to marvel at her. We were in a small hotel owned by a former boxer, a pugilist, a real tough guy. If he got into an argument with anyone who worked for him and they got smart, he just beat them up and threw them off the property. That type of guy. Everyone was terrified of him, an old-school New York Jewish kind of street fighter type. So he ruled his little hotel with an iron fist. Because he was tough, things ran right. Nothing ever went wrong. No one robbed cutlery. No one talked back. So anyway, I'm a kid 15 years old, and boom, it's Love by the Sewer Plant. We crossed the road to walk down to the Neversink River to make out. The water was so cold that when you waded across it, your feet turned blue. My uncle had a new Plymouth Fury, so I remember the time. This girl was so stunningly gorgeous, just really beautiful, and the theater companies would come through. They had entertainment in those little hotels and small theaters that they called casinos for a night of entertainment. Sometimes they'd have a comedian who was terrible, a juggler, or a balloon man doing cheap acts. In other words, schlocky entertainment. Nevertheless, these guys, these women, they thought they were artists. You've got to understand that. Even though they were schlocky entertainers, let's say they could paint velvet paintings, to themselves, they were still painters. In their minds, they were Van Goghs. They were theatrical, and everyone else was boring. In other words, they were the artists. They understood beauty. So one day a group of these entertainers came around and just stared at this girl. They came running up to her, even though I was holding her hand as if I wasn't there. I was holding her hand and walking with her. We were just kids. One of these artistes said, "Man, I wanted you to see this girl," to one of his friends. "This is the girl I was telling you about." They looked at her like she was a specimen of biblical beauty. Where are you going to go when you're a kid and you got nowhere to go? So we took a walk down the hill. It was a long slope down to the river, where there was a sewer treatment plant, which occasionally, as you well know, doesn't smell that good. Kids don't care, though. They don't care how it smells. They don't care what it's like. They can override anything, particularly when the lust hits them. So we two kids walk down the hill, cross the river, roll up the dungarees, take off our shoes. Our legs are blue, and we have a little moment of passion together. It was my first moment of passion, and not exactly on the level of a complete moment of passion. But for me, it was the first of that type. So now I'm starstruck. Coming back to my... I'm going to stop right here. I'll go to the next paragraph. There were not enough stars in the sky that night, in the black sky, the billions of stars to equal the passion that I had for the world. I thought I could literally reach out and grab a star and fly away. That's how phenomenal I felt that evening. But then, of course, as you well know, nothing like that lasts. So what I'm going to get at with this story is that it was by a sewer plant, and there's nothing more to it. Now imagine some John Coltrane, because there's no more to the story. That's all I care to tell. If I tell any more, it will become a pantomime, and I don't want to embarrass myself with a pantomime of something that was quite beautiful. This story ends quite abruptly. Good jazz ends abruptly. Guys, play a little Coltrane so they know what I'm talking about. So my book is like a jazz poem. Many of them are like jazz pieces. Now this is starting to sound like LaBrie's Waterbeds. This is the wrong part of it. We get it like to a better point, something a little more poignant, maybe a little jazz that moves. Otherwise, they're going to go to sleep and they're going to get comatose. I'm going to wait another 30 seconds. Then either I'm going to break the record or we're going to pick another. Here we go. Now we go. Thank you. Now you got it. Come on. Picture a hopped up drummer, man. Not someone on PCP. you know. I think 50s Jack Kerouac. Now you talk. Now you got it. Now we're there. Now we're moving. Moving. Now you hit it exactly right. That's the tone of the Savage Nation I suggest. Oh my God, that's good. Worst nightmares, please. I don't want to get 1,000 pictures now from women around the country. Dear Dr. Savage, here I am outside my sewer plant. I don't want to get 1,000 pictures of women in various stages of undress of them outside sewer plants. Now, please don't. I don't want it. It's a story. It's just a reverie. I'm not one of those radio guys, you know what I'm saying, who's trolling. I'm not trolling. End of story. Forget it. Oh, you have to be so careful. The power of suggestion.
Savage.
U.S. couples seek separate bedrooms. Ah, look at this story. A survey by the National Association of Home Builders has predicted by 2015... 60% of custom-built homes will have two master bedroom suites. This is an amazing story. The quest for better rest is behind the trend, as experts say the lack of decent sleep can cause marital tension. The option of having separate rooms has often improved marriages, they say. And they're not calling it separate bedrooms because people are embarrassed to admit it. They call it a flex suite to avoid any embarrassment. And it says the trend is not restricted to the upper end of the market. They say that with the practical necessity, snoring, nighttime visits to the bathroom, children, shift working, couples are often deprived a good night's sleep, so they're having two separate master suites. Let me tell you a little secret about that. It's only the poor who sleep in the same bed for their whole life, generally, and not everybody, don't get me wrong. It's a mark of poverty to have to share a bed with someone your whole life. The fact of the matter is, if you study the history of this, let's start with the royalty. They never shared the same bedroom. Never mind the same bed. We're not talking about in the beginning phases when they're in the 90 days of marital heat. That's an understood fact. The 90-day period is over after 90, 91 days, according to every study that's ever been done. 90 days of insanity, by 91 days already, it's over. It goes on to a certain extent, but after 90 days, you have to live with this person. So first it starts out as twin beds in the same room, very close to each other with a little nightstand. Then it's not so much twin beds, you get the bigger beds in the same room. Then if you have a little money, it's two bedrooms. That's how it works. But that's the fact of the matter. There's no shame in it. You can still get together when you want. But you have two different lives, two different minds. Why do you have to share every second in the bedroom? What, that's some sacred place to be there? The way people are today individually, they don't want to be in the same room. And by the way, this is not limited to America. I spent many years, I'll give you an example, an anthropological experience about men and women. In Fiji, let's go back to the years I was going to Fiji in the village. And this is a delicate subject. The men had a men's house and the women had a women's house. And when the women went through their monthly cycle, the women went into the women's house with the other women. The men didn't want to be around them. Now, what does that make the men in Fiji? Does it make them sexist? Does it make them whatever ist you want to call it? They know from their culture that they didn't want to be around the woman at that time for whatever the reasons were. And I got news for you. The woman would rather be with her friends at that time than the guy. So he went over to the friend's house. They all hung out and slept in the same big straw hut. And the women slept together. That's how they did it in Fiji. I'm giving you one example. So this whole idea of how to raise a child or how to live with a woman or a woman how to live with a man, there's no set rule. There's no set rules in this area. And a lot of what we see going on today is a devolution, not an evolution. The people don't even actually understand how to live with each other or how to raise children. And what they always do is try the liberal methodology in every case on the natch, and they think that by going on the natch with liberalism, it's going to work, and it often doesn't. What you have to do is go back to the traditional methods of raising children and the traditional methods of living in the same household, man and woman, woman and man.
It's a deep right field. That ball is going. It is gone. Maris hitting his second homer of the day.
The Yankees switch homer.
And there is the nostalgia setup, the Mel Allen voice, one of the greatest voices radio has ever heard, and one of the earliest radio voices that I came to love. And here I am sitting in front of a microphone with a radio voice that millions love. And I'm going to close the hour out now with another story that will be in my autobiography. And it's called My First Embalming, since we talked about The Undertaker, and here it is. I was now a late teenager, and I had gone to Europe, big trip to Europe. You know, hippie, beatnik trip to Europe, see the museums, blah, 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 came back on a ship. I come back from Europe, and I thought I had become a little off base. It was a little kind of teenage angst, little nuts. So I took a job in a mortuary at Queens General Hospital. I can remember it to this day. Red brick, big smokestack, looked like a crematorium. And I go in there as an assistant to just basically mop up and sweep up in a mortuary. And I had never seen an embalming. I don't know why I took that job of all jobs. It was like a bizarre choice to begin with. I guess it proves I was a little off base after going to Europe. But then again, I wouldn't be the first nor the last person to come back from Europe and think they were a little crazy. Just take a look at Europe. So I go down into the thing, and the guy gives me an apron and a mop. And he says, "Just basically, your job is to mop up the floor." But meanwhile, I'm watching the autopsies. This was not this is really my first autopsy, not my first embalming. It's my first autopsy. So I watched a doctor. Now, here's a doctor with a medical degree. He was a medical examiner performing an autopsy. He has a cigar in his mouth, which I thought was weird and kind of disrespectful to the dead. The guy is chomping on a cigar. He cuts open a dead woman's head, like the top of her head, to pull back the skull cap and to remove the brains for, you know, that's what an autopsy is you examine the organs. And I'll never forget it as long as I lived. She happened to have been an African-American lady and a large woman, and he was pulling and pulling and pulling, and the skull wouldn't pull off, and he puts his foot up against the gurney that she's on, or the stainless steel thing, and pulling and cursing and the cigar, and I'm mopping, the kid in the room there. I couldn't believe what I'm watching. And finally, he curses, and there it comes out, and that's it. So now then I see another man. A man must have been 50, 55, white man in good shape, just slim, gray-haired, but not old-looking, dead. And he was completely naked, as you would expect, on a slab. And the kid's mopping, and I look very carefully at the corpse. And I noticed some semen on his thigh, which again was novel and unique because I didn't understand much about death at that time, as much as I since learned. And then there was a young child, 2 or 3 years old, as beautiful as a doll, blonde hair, blue eyes, like a doll, still and dead, for no reason.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
Tucson, Arizona. TJ, you're on The Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, sir. I'm responding to the comments Sally Fields made about if women were ruling things, this world would be better and there wouldn't be any wars. My contention that if women were ruling things, this world would be far worse than what it is. And I cite the examples is the dating habits of women. There are a lot of men joining the Bloods and the Crips to get girls. A lot of times I've been picked on or harassed or whatever by men, it was because they were trying to get the sexual favors of other women. It was a woman.
You're saying that men fight with each other because of women to show that they're more dominant?
And I'm also saying that because women are responsive to that, by virtue of that, they encourage violence in men.
Some women do. I would say that is true. There's actually a biological, imperative in the sense that the women want the most viable male to produce offspring with. She wants usually a man who can defend her and who is, more liable to produce, let's say, a strong child.
Well, it gets carried to the extreme of killing over a woman. Of course, I think that's another story. But by a lot, look, let's look at the animal kingdom in order to draw some conclusions, TJ. The moose who will bang heads in order to attract the female. Wherever you look, you're going to see male animals fighting with each other in order to get the female. Isn't that true? Look at the lions. They'll chase, the old male will be chased away eventually by a younger lion. He is then shunned from the tribe. He's no longer considered a viable mate for the women. The girl lions, the female lions, rather, they want the most viable male. And in our society, the women tend to want a nerdy guy today rather than the macho guy. The smart women do, because they know the nerdy guy will make more money and probably is smart enough to avoid getting killed.
Uh-huh. Well, you see, you're making the point that in order to impress a woman, you have to behave like an animal.
I mean, you got me there, TJ. And by the way, I'm not going to argue with you.
It was a woman who wanted the head of John the Baptist on a silver platter.
TJ, you set me up pretty good on that one. I got to thank you for it. I don't know any examples in history of benevolent women leaders, do you? I mean, which women leaders come to mind as let's say there'd be no wars if there were women leaders? Who are they thinking about? Let's say there was a woman leader of Pakistan. Remember Bhutto? Her father had been assassinated. Then she became a leader of Pakistan. I mean, wherever you look, okay, Golda Meir, she was far more macho and had more of you-know-what, more testosterone than Shimon Peres. How about Margaret Thatcher? I mean, I admire those women, but they weren't peaceniks. None of them were.
But sometimes you need to have war. Sometimes if you avoid a war, it causes a war. I mean, for example—
Absolutely, and sometimes it's better to have a war early on before your enemy becomes too strong and you're going to— Let's, for example, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. Right now he's a pipsqueak. He can be wiped out overnight. He has no military to speak of. He is, though, in cahoots with Ahmadinejad. He's trying to get nuclear weapons. He's buying submarines. This guy, if he is not stopped, will wind up causing a bigger war, and there'll be more Americans and Venezuelans dying 5 years from now or 10 years from now than they would die right now. So an argument can be made that he should be stopped before he gets bigger. I think that's what you're saying, isn't it?
Well, go back to World War II. Had William Chamberlain had not been appeasing Hitler, and had we just taken him out from the beginning? As a matter of fact, I heard a story that the orders were cut to arrest Hitler for violating the previous treaties from World War I.
Yes,
and,
you're 100% right. If Hitler had been stopped at Munich, World War II could have been aborted. Tens of millions of people wouldn't have died. It's the same with Ahmadinejad coming to New York. Why should a new Hitler, which is who Ahmadinejad is spiritually, intellectually, in every way, he's saying the same things Hitler did. He wants the nuclear weapons so he can terrorize the world and kill people. He does not want it for peaceful reasons. If that man was stopped now, we could avoid a larger war, which is why, thank God, George Bush is showing all the signs of doing the right thing, and so is France. I hope they do. I hope they do go ahead with it. I don't know where you stand on that one. Do you think we should go and take out Iranian military targets?
Oh, definitely. I think we should have done that when we went in with Iraq at the same time. Oh, getting back to women, though, there's a belief system that women mature faster than men, and I don't believe that. I believe women just at an earlier age desire to have a mate. That does not necessarily equate with the fact that women are mature, because all you have to do is look at how they behave in divorce courts.
You know, you're the best misogynist I've had on in years, TJ. You really sound jaundiced. What happened to you?
Well, first of all, some of the most cruelest things have either been done to me either by women or by men who were trying to impress women, and I've made those observations very young in life. I wasn't even a teenager by that point, and I don't worship women.
I'm not going to argue with you. You're not the only man on earth who feels a little intimidated by the gentle sex. All I know is this. When the Year of the Woman came along in Congress around 92, 93, 94, do you remember the speeches we heard? That when women were elected, we'd have a more gentler Congress, et cetera. Now, I ask you, when you look at Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, Barbara Mikulski, do you feel that we have a gentler, kinder Congress?
We have a cattier Congress.
Well, let's look at Dianne Feinstein and her husband, Richard Blum. Would you say that we have a more honest Senate with Dianne Feinstein as a U.S. Senator?
No,
do you think that if a man did what Dianne Feinstein allegedly is doing, in terms of steering contracts from committees that she sat on, defense contracts to her. Let's say it was a man sitting on a defense committee, and he steers contracts to his wife's consulting firm, and she's worth hundreds of billions of dollars. Do you think that man would have stayed in office as long as Dianne Feinstein has?
Yes, sir, as long long as he was a catty, effeminized, liberal man.
You got me there again. You have a pretty good sense of humor, TJ. How do you survive in Tucson, Arizona? Are you calling from penitentiary?
In a way, yes, sir.
You are incarcerated because I did invite people from prisons to call last week.
No,
are you actually calling from? You're not in a lock. You're in a mental hospital or a prison?
No, I meant that more figuratively, not literally.
I know you did. I was just kidding. But you have any relationships with women at all? Mother, sister, children, daughters? No.
Right now, I'm trying to get over a sports injury, so I'm staying away from the dating scene. But to be honest with you, it was my sister who re-injured my sporting injury.
So you're saying you were in a cast and she came in and twisted your ankle?
More specifically, I have torn cartilage in my back, and she took me on this Bag Mountain dirt road with a bunch of potholes on it, and I told her that I had a physician's order to stay off of pothole-ridden roads. She lied to me, and her husband drove like about 50 miles an hour over the potholes, and so I have an MRI report that shows that my disc was healing. And
oh, my God. This is a really serious story here. So you're a little leery of women to begin with. Now, on top of it all, your own blood turns out to be untrustworthy when it comes to this.
Let me tell you this story. Whenever I'm in bars and I'm meeting women and telling me about how rotten the ex-boyfriends were and abusive, I ask them, what's he doing? And when they kind of shrug their shoulders and say, I don't know, I'll tell them straight up, well, if you can't even tell me what the problem is and what he's doing, how do I know that you're not the one that's instigating the bad behaviors? And, a lot of women are actually turned on by that. I've never had a drink thrown in my face, but the bottom line is you can go into bars all over the country with a bunch of women who are berating their exes, and every man knows that they're lying, and whatever it is they did that to provoke the problem is being left out of the story. But still, men will,
yeah, of course. You have to go, stare them in the eye, too, and buy them another drink.
See, nobody tells women the truth that when they're wrong, and so what you have is a whole society of women who really don't have a good fix.
Yeah, well, you want to get a heart attack, tell a woman when she's wrong. Have you met a woman yet who will admit she's wrong in your whole life?
I've met some women where you could get away with it more than other women, and
I'm amazed. There are some brilliant, intelligent women out there who can never admit they're wrong, though. There's something about the feline nature of a woman that it's very hard for them to say they were wrong. I don't get that. I don't understand that part of it. If I'm wrong, I admit I'm wrong. It's not easy for me, but I'll have to admit it in order to go forward myself. Okay, you're an honest guy. I want to ask you something. You heard the story I read today from the website. Federal prosecutor arrested in child sexting. He was trying to have sex with a 5-year-old girl. What do you think of a story like this? What's your reaction to that?
Well, my reaction to that is the death penalty for people who do things like that. One trial, one appeal, and that'll get rid of those kinds of problems.
But could you believe this man works for the U.S. Justice Department as an assistant U.S. attorney in Florida?
Yes, sir, I can. I mean, just look at the activities of the ACLU and what our criminal judicial system is letting them get away with.
You're good. TJ, you should head up the Savage Nation in Tucson. You're like a one-man Savage Nation in Tucson.
I could probably do it for maybe 15 minutes. And
you wouldn't have patience, I know. Well, let me send you a gift. I got to send you a gift. You pick it. You want the CD? You want the Healing Children Naturally? You want the Alzheimer's book? Anything else I can send you from the cornucopia of Savage items?
The CD would be great.
TJ, stay on the line. We're going to get you the Michael Savage DVD Freedom of Speech Award by Talkers Mag. You'll see me gesticulating wildly with my New Yorker hands. Teddy does make a little doggy appearance. He's not a SAG employee, so I got him for cheap. I got him for not even a bone out of that one. I got him for a cup of water and a pat on the head. I'll be right back. Savage. We're now going to move on to beer, wine, guns, beer, boats, wine, guns, cameras, stuff I never talk about because I'm so tired of the other stuff. I'm so tired of it. So let's go to the callers, okay? Chicago, Thomas, go ahead. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to talk about my boat. The first boat I had was a 1972 Chris-Craft with double Rolls-Royce engines, actually.
And, wow. Rolls-Royce engines? That wasn't factory, was it?
No, it wasn't. It was actually a boat that I inherited from a wealthy side of my family. I really didn't even know what to do with the boat.
That is amazing. But do Rolls-Royce engines do well in a marine environment?
Honestly, Mike.
No, I would imagine so. They use them in the air. What am I asking? Of course they must do well anywhere.
Rolls-Royce engines is the most amazing boat. But at the time, it was a little bit over my head. It's a 38-foot boat. The maintenance, all of that stuff was just crazy. But when you said you wanted to talk about guns, I mean, there's the new SIG 9mm, single action, double action.
Okay. Oh, you've touched a raw nerve. I went and bought a SIG P-232 with a 380 cartridge. I can't use the gun. I don't like it. I don't like double action guns at all.
Yes.
Don't like them. I'm going to return the gun. No, I'm going to try and trade it back. I've never fired it. I just don't like the gun. I have, and I've had it for 25 years. My favorite handgun is really basic. It's the Colt Combat Commander 45. That is a weapon that is, I don't think there's anything you can beat it. WOR, Bob, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yeah, I have a Glock 19. I'm an NYU graduate. Went in there as a moderate, came out to the right of you. But
how did that? Wait, you must have majored in engineering. Certainly not in sociology.
Well, I took a class in sociology, and it was filled with communist professors, and they're really brainwashing, young innocent minds. They focus.
Well, that's why there are so many suicides at NYU. I'm sorry to say, why are they throwing themselves off buildings there? How can the kids take it?
I don't know if it's that or the tuition, Mike, but I want to talk about the reason why. I hear you like a Colt 45, and those are excellent firearms. But when it comes to home defense, you need a good flashlight, and I like a Glock 19.
Well, let's talk about it. Many people listening to this show are experts in guns, and many of them are not, and some are thinking about getting a handgun. There's something to be said for a semi-automatic handgun and something to be said for a revolver. Why is a revolver something people consider having by their nightstand as opposed to a semi-automatic? You could answer that very simply. Why?
Because a
revolver is a point and shoot gun. You don't have to pull back on the gun. You just pick it up and fire it. A semi-automatic, you're going to have to pull back unless you leave it charged, which I would never do with a round in the chamber. I would never leave a semi-automatic with a round in the chamber spring loaded like that. I just wouldn't do it. But on the other hand, a revolver is much more reliable in that regard. They're not going to jam on you generally. 5 shots, 6 shots max, as opposed to 14 shots, so that's a disadvantage. They say that the shotgun is still your best friend in a bedroom. A nice old shotgun, pump shotgun, best friend in the dark. 1-800-449-8255, phone number. Any topic is fair game. Guns, cars, cameras. You want to talk about cameras? Cameras have changed to such an extent that I don't know there's much to talk about. Everything's automatic today. I'm using a Nikon D70 that I bought about two, 3 years ago, whenever it came out. It's far more complicated than my little Sony, but the new gigabytes on the little tiny Sony are astounding. And on my website, michaelsavage.com, the pictures you're seeing so far are with the Nikon D70, but I have a whole panel of pictures coming up with my little Sony. I think it's a 9 gigabyte, small, it's the size of a credit card. I never saw a camera like this. But I still like the heft and feel of a big camera. Although if you want to take a picture of a bum in San Francisco, I would suggest you get a smaller camera because you can get away with more. You don't have to like aim it, You can sort of like hold it. That's the better one to use if you're taking anonymous pictures. The credit card size camera is better. Tim, Sacramento, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Dr. Savage. I was wondering, have you ever touched on Power Cats? Because I know that they're really hot in Australia. And you can get, you got a shallow draft, 4-foot draft on a 65-footer, and you can use a couple 700 horsepower Cummins. And
what is that? Oh, a catamaran?
Power Cats, yeah. They're really popular in Australia.
It's funny you should ask. When I lived years ago in the tropics, catamarans were very popular amongst the sailing folks. There was something about it that was not traditional that I couldn't relate to, the double hull. I know they sailed flat and people loved them. I just never related to them. To me, a boat has to have a single hull to be a boat. I can't relate to it. There's certain things that don't compute in my head. One of them is a double-hulled sailing, a double-hulled vessel.
Oh, yeah. I was wondering, what size is your Grand Banks?
It's a Europa 42.
Those are beautiful. Yeah, my dream is to have a custom-built yacht by Delta Marine or Delta Outdoor.
Oh, yeah, they're magnificent, gigantic, though. You're talking about a 150-foot boat, though.
Well, yeah, well, they'll do a custom order. You can get a nice 65-footer with an ice-strengthened steel hull. That way you can go up into Alaska, have a four-stateroom layout.
Wow.
Take friends. Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah, I don't know if I could take that much time on a boat anymore. I mean, I'm a day boater. Truthfully, Tim, I'm not an overnighter. I'd rather come back to my house, and that's about it. I'm a day boater right now. There may be a time later on which I'll do overnights on a boat, but not right now. Thank you for the call. I have one quick call to take, then I'll go to a break. It's splinter advice from Jeff in Houston, Texas. Jeff, go ahead, please. Give me splinter advice.
Yes, I was going to tell you, I worked in a wood shop, and what you need to do is take your one-sided razor blade that has a handle on one side, like the box cutter.
And cut my throat.
No, you slowly, where the splinter is, you shave the skin real slow. It might take you about 20 minutes, but just lightly use the sharp edge of the blade and keep rubbing over it, rubbing over it, rubbing over it, and you'll be taking little bitty pieces of skin off. You won't even notice it, but you'll see the little, it's like sawdust. And eventually, when you keep going over it and over it, your blade will hit the splinter, and you can just keep doing that and go under it and kind of pull up, and then you can pull it out with your finger. I used to work at a wood shop, and I did it all the time.
Well, I see a little black piece of the splinter poking its head out. As you were talking to me, I was playing with my thumbnail, and it came out. So thanks for reminding me to remove it.
Savage.
Here in San Francisco, they banned plastic bags in supermarkets. They said it's bad for the environment because the plastic bags don't deteriorate or disintegrate. They sit in the landfill for thousands of years. They're very concerned about the environment in San Francisco, as I say. So now you have to have a paper bag when you leave a grocery store. And if you're walking out in the rain, it doesn't matter to the city of transsexuals who run the city. The paper bag, of course, disintegrates in the rain and your groceries get wet. The plastic was much better and much more convenient. But let's take it on the face of it. So plastic is not biodegradable, right? Then how come they distribute condoms in San Francisco like M&Ms? Isn't that made of a plastic? You're telling me that the condoms that are so popular with the city transsexuals don't sit in landfills for 20,000 years? You see the hypocrisy and stupidity? Or they tell us that the salmon population is dying out, that the salmon here, we're supposed to worry about, that the salmon are not breeding. We don't read that the people are not breeding. Only that the salmon are not breeding, so now they're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars. Nobody will say that perhaps the toxic garbage that is dumped offshore.